Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Austin Peterson here, former presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party. Today is Monday, April the 10th, and first, a word from our sponsors.
A big thank you to my sponsor, Podbean. I use Podbean's hosting services for the Freedom Report podcast, and let me just tell you, it's been absolutely great. It's a wonderful home for this podcast. If you're considering starting your own podcast, Podbean offers an easy-to-use platform with all the tools you'll need. Now they make it even easier with the ability to record podcasts on the go with their podcast app. Record and publish right from your phone. If you want to give Podbean a try, go to podbean.com/freedom and you'll get 1 month free. That's podbean.com/freedom.
And welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for supporting the Freedom Report podcast. You can find us on iTunes or on Stitcher, but I do highly recommend the Podbean app, just like I was talking about in the commercial that we had at the beginning of this. If you want to download these and listen to them on the go, the Podbean app is a terrific way to do it. It's also got lots of other great podcasts from some of your favorite libertarian peeps like Jason Stapleton and others. So definitely check that out if you don't listen to us on Facebook. I know we've got a pretty large audience over there that listens to them when I stream over there. But again, if you don't have time to listen to it live, you can always listen and download us on one of our apps. Again, Stitcher is for the Android. And of course, if you've got iOS, you can find us on iTunes as well. Just type the Freedom Report in. And while you're there, do me a favor, give me a 5-star review. Just click that 5-star button, give us a review, a written review if you really like your boy Augie P. Well, it is a beautiful morning in Kansas City, at least while I'm recording this. Maybe you're listening to it later, but it's one of those gorgeous days that makes you like sad to have to stay inside and work all day. I may try and sneak out. I work for myself, whatever. I'll do what I want. Speaking of doing what you want, but doing what you want without congressional authorization, today we're going to be talking about the strikes on Syria again. We're going to continue this topic just because there's been some more news over the weekend. And one of the most interesting parts of this has been to see the response from many of Donald Trump's supporters, many of his ardent supporters, people who helped him win the nomination for president in the Republican Party, and people who went on to become some of his biggest campaigners, have expressed their disappointment over Donald Trump's actions in Syria. So we're going to take a look at that a little bit later. But first, we've got some amazing, amazing news, some terrific news, some huge news. And it's the kind of news that I think that this audience would really enjoy. So I'm going to read that news to you first, because I think that this is probably something you all enjoy. Then we'll talk about Trump's troll army and what they thought about the strikes, what Rand Paul thought about the strikes. And then we're going to talk about what some libertarian foreign policy experts and conservative foreign policy experts have been writing about the attack in Syria. So first up, from LA Times, it's amazing article. Headline, Hillary Clinton says she won't run for public office again. Now, I know, you're like, well, she could be lying. Well, of course, she's a politician. What do you expect? But as a former politician, I can say that we don't all lie. We don't all lie, just the ones who get elected. But no, I'm kidding. All right, that was a little salty, a little salt bay for you this morning. But yeah. So April 6th yesterday, this is not yesterday, this is a few days ago, my bad. Hillary Clinton said she doesn't intend to run for elected office again, but vowed to remain involved in public service and to help Democrats regain control of Congress in the 2018 election. Good luck with that. In her first post-election interview, Clinton alluded to the pain of her loss of the presidency to Donald Trump, hinting that there were times she didn't want to get out of bed. Quote, "The aftermath of the election was so devastating," Clinton said Thursday during the Women in the World Summit, hosted by Tina Brown at New York's Lincoln Center. Quote, "I had to make up my mind I was going to get out of bed. Yes, I was going to take walks in the woods. Yes. As a person, I'm okay. As an American, I'm pretty worried," said Clinton. Among her worries, she cited President Trump's policies towards women and health care, Russian interference in the election, and the downward spiral of Syria. Clinton said she believed it was not too late for the U.S. to declare a no-fly zone and attack Syrian government airfields to deprive President Bashar Assad's air force of the ability to bomb civilians. Quote, "That air force is the cause of most of the civilian deaths, as we have seen over the years and as we saw in the last few days," said Clinton, referring to Tuesday's chemical weapons strike in Syria's Idlib province that killed more than 70 civilians. Quote, "I really believe that we should have, and still should, take out his airfields and prevent him from being able to use them to bomb innocent people and drop sarin gas on them." Okay. Well, yeah. So this is why, if you're a follower of my Instagram account, you'll I had a very popular meme, a very spicy, very also spicy meme the other day. And it showed Hillary Clinton crying and saying, "But I wanted to bomb Syria." So it leads one to wonder, you know, if we had had a Hillary Clinton as president, would we have even an expanded war in Syria? I think the answer to that is yes. So the funny thing is that we're going to read an article here from Politico in just a moment about how Trump's troll army is angry at Trump over the strikes. There have been some news reports this weekend that there won't be a push for a wider war, that there won't be a push for regime change. At least we're keeping our fingers crossed, right? We're hoping. But undoubtedly, if we'd had Hillary Clinton, there would have been this strike and more in Syria. So Hillary was definitely the war candidate. Usually the pro-war candidate doesn't win. And it doesn't matter what the president does once they're elected. But if you run as the anti-war candidate or as the one who's more skeptical about military interventions, you tend to have a better time. I mean, a perfect example of this would be, and I've got a nice little anecdote, is when my father was in the Green Berets in the late 1960s, the presidential election it was in the 60s. This would have been Goldwater versus LBJ. So I guess that was, 1964? Let me just double check that. I'm still on my first cup of coffee. So it's, 1964. Okay, so my father, this has been early 60s. So my father was in the Green Berets, or just joined the Army. And he was going around to a political speech, and Barry Goldwater was there. And, you know, being in the military, he had some opinions about whether or not the military should be going to war in Vietnam or not. And he heard Barry Goldwater say that they were going to bomb the hell out of him. And he was terrified, and so he voted for LBJ. Sorry, Dad, didn't mean to out you there, but that was the last Democrat for president that my dad ever voted for, because once LBJ got in, my dad was upset because LBJ went on and killed a whole bunch of his buddies, got a whole bunch of his buddies killed. And whenever we visit the wall in Washington, D.C., Dad always sheds a tear and says a prayer for his good buddies that he lost in that no-win war in Vietnam. And, of course, we have Donald Trump, and he soundly defeated Hillary Clinton as someone who was skeptical of the war in Iraq, someone who was a critic. I mean, Donald Trump was a huge critic of Barack Obama's planned bombing of Syria. If you remember back in 2013, President Barack Obama was trying to get authorization from Congress in order to expand the war in Syria to Bashar al-Assad, not just targeting ISIS, right? So John McCain is upset because he thinks that too much focus has been spent on blowing up our enemies, our real enemies, the terrorists in Syria, the rebels and that are aligned with ISIS. And John McCain is upset because we hadn't expanded the war to Bashar al-Assad. So he was gloating and feeling happy as can be. Well, when Donald Trump decided to launch Tomahawk strikes into Syria to an airfield that ended up killing like 9 military members, 7 civilians, a couple of them are children. But we had to kill the children to save the children. I mean, it's really important that we understand that we are the moral actors here, right? If we want to save some kids, we've got to bomb some kids. And that's really what the military policy, the stated military policy here is. We've seen some sad pictures coming out of Syria, and so we have to throw away the Constitution. We can't obey the Constitution because when we see sad pictures, the Constitution doesn't apply to sad pictures. And, you know, the Founding Fathers didn't even have pictures. But if the Founding Fathers had seen sad pictures, they probably would have thrown it out the window. But let's be honest, we all know that as soon as the Constitution was passed, the Founding Fathers went to work right away with pushing the Constitution aside. I mean, John Adams passed the Alien and Sedition Acts to silence political dissent. Thomas Jefferson, Louisiana Purchase, not constitutional. But that's the thing. Once you get in power, power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And I actually have seen some people, and I discussed this in the last podcast, but I just want to rehash this. I've seen some people justifying the attacks in Syria saying, well, you know, Thomas Jefferson went to the Barbary Wars without congressional authorization of war. Well, you're missing out some important details on that story. I actually just finished a really good book about Jefferson and the Barbary Wars by Brian Kilmeade, of all people. I know, don't make fun of me, but I didn't expect it to be as good as it was, but I just wanted to read somebody's take on Jeffersonian. But if you like Jeffersonian history, definitely check out this book, Jefferson and the Barbary Wars. But the difference between what happened with Jefferson and what happened in Syria is that we were actually attacked in the Barbary Wars. You have to understand that American merchant shipping going through the Mediterranean was subject to pirate attacks. Other countries who were paying tribute, countries like Britain and France or Spain, those countries weren't at war with the Barbary pirates as much because they were paying tribute. And the United States tried to pay tribute, but because we were still a young nation, we were kind of a poor nation, and we weren't able to pay these exorbitant fees to the Tripolitan pirates and Algiers, the Dey of Algiers. We were forced into a corner. So what Jefferson did, and you have to remember, it took 3 months for news to get back to the United States about the fact that the Barbary pirates declared war on the United States, and it took 3 months to get back. Well, Jefferson, what he did was he asked Congress for authorization to build the Navy. They built 4 ships, I think the USS Constitution and others. And then he sent them to the Mediterranean coasts, and it was authorized by Congress for him to do that. And that's different, right? It's not the same as what Trump did, which is not to go to Congress. He just launched airstrikes, and we now know that it was just part of a warning shot, very expensive warning shot, something like 50, 60 Tomahawk missiles sent in that didn't actually take out the airfields. John McCain is upset. He's upset because we didn't do enough. We didn't bomb the airfields. We didn't crater them out. And that's really the situation that we're faced with. But it's not like Jefferson and the Barbary Wars, because Jefferson sought congressional authorization, and he gave those ships explicit orders to protect American merchant shipping. That's what they were for. They weren't there to go and do a humanitarian intervention because, you know, the Dey of Algiers and the Tripolitan pirates were killing babies, right? They were doing something that was in America's best interest. And I really, really hate the arguments from the war hawks and the sycophants that just mindlessly say, oh, well, if you don't want to intervene, then that means that you're okay with gassing babies. I'm so tempted to use bad words here, but I just don't want to lower myself. So I'm just going to say that it's obvious that these people don't care about the babies because they don't want to let refugees in, right? They look at those pictures of the babies, you know, that are drowned, washing up on the coast of Southern Europe, trying to flee the war in Syria, the expanding war in Syria, and they don't care about those. I mean, as a matter of fact, when I saw those pictures being posted around, I saw so many people hating on it. So actually, I saw people gleefully enjoying it. And those people are obviously demented, right? And probably don't make up the vast majority of people who are against refugees. I would hope not, at least. But it is disingenuous to say, oh, you care about the babies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, someone else brought up a fallacy to me, and we're going to get to the main topic here in just a moment. But someone else brought up a fallacy to me yesterday. They said, well, what about the Holocaust? Right? What do you say, Austin, when somebody looks at these pictures of gas and says, well, should we have not intervened in the Holocaust? Okay, so let's unpack this for just a moment, because if you're a libertarian and you're tired of getting that argument as well, and you want to be able to respond to it, well, then first let's understand what that argument is doing, what it's saying in context here, and then let's try and discuss how you can turn that argument around on someone. Because here's the thing. If you look at that argument, what someone is doing is they're engaging in hyperbole, okay? Hyperbole is when you take an argument to its absolute extreme, sometimes over-exaggerated, right? So this chemical attack was not on par with the level of the Holocaust. It's obviously a false equivocation. That person is engaging in hyperbole. But what I want you to do is consider this, right? There's two kind of people in this argument. There's one group of people that were just saying that so they can be hyperbolic, who don't care about truth, who don't care about logic, who are immune to any of your arguments of reason. Ignore those people. Don't waste your time on those people. You never argue with an idiot because they're going to drag you down to their level and beat you with their experience. Then there's another group of people who use that argument and they use it sincerely. They use it because they actually want to know, if there was a Holocaust, what do you think we should do, right? So what do you think that the United States should be? So if you find someone who's actually not immune to reason on this discussion and they bring up the Holocaust argument, here's what I would encourage you to do. The first thing to do is not immediately jump on them, right? Don't immediately argue with them. Don't roll your eyes. If you think that they're being sincere, this is what you say. You say, okay, so if there is a chemical attack in Syria like this, or let's say it's on par with the level of the Holocaust, my question to you is this. My question to you is how much responsibility does the United States have from a moral and from a technical perspective? How much responsibility does the United States have to stop every heinous act around the world, to play policeman of the world? How much moral responsibility? Is it 100% moral responsibility and no one else in the world has any moral responsibility whatsoever? So let's just parcel it out, okay? Then we say 100% responsibility. Okay, so does the United States have 100% responsibility? Does the United Nations, does the international community have some moral responsibility as well? If that's the case, if the United States doesn't have 100% moral responsibility, let's say, okay, so then maybe 50% responsibility, all right? And then ask them how they would parcel them out. So then their logic is starting to break down here at this point. And then you can up the ante, and then you can say, okay, so let me ask you a question. At what point should the United States bankrupt itself? Should the United States use 100% of its resources? So if they say, oh yes, we have 100% moral responsibility, okay, well then they're still being hyperbolic. So then you can say, okay, so then does the United States, if we have a 100% moral responsibility, do we have a 100% financial responsibility as well? Meaning that 100% of the resources of the United States has to go to stop every tragedy around the world. That's the question. And then if they say 100% financial responsibility, well, you're being hyperbolic. Well, you can say, well, so are you. So it's perfectly legitimate for you to use a Holocaust example for every tragedy that occurs around the world and to say that the United States has 100% moral responsibility to do it. Well, then is it feasible to say that we should have 100% financial responsibility? Should we completely drown ourselves and destroy ourselves in order to help other people? Listen, if you're on a life raft in the middle of the ocean, I mean, I believe in helping refugees, but if you're on a life raft in the middle of the ocean and you're getting swamped and you don't have enough room to house and feed everybody, it's a horrible crime. It's a horrible, not a crime, it's a horrible, heinous act for you to not help those people. But if you don't have enough room, it reminds me of the helicopter in Saigon when they were fleeing the roof after the Tet Offensive, when the Marines and everybody was trying to get out of the embassy in Saigon, and the helicopters were overloaded and they were punching people to get them off. Not because they hated those people, but they wanted to help those people, but they knew that if they did, then they were going to swamp themselves. At some point, self-preservation is a thing, right? And I haven't been the biggest fan of the America First, like, Trump teams, who we're going to get to right now in just a moment. But you have to understand that if people are immune to logic, you can't argue with them. But if they're not immune to logic and they're using hyperbolic examples, you are free to go engage in as much hyperbole as you like on the other side, provided that you build yourself up to it. Because what you don't want to do is just blow them away with hyperbole right away. Then it destroys like the credibility in the conversation. So just remember that, you know, these are the arguments that we have to consider. Like, does the United States have a 100% moral obligation? Do we have a 100% financial obligation? And my answer to that is that we do not have a 100% moral or financial obligation in terms of the government of the United States. Maybe we have a moral obligation ourselves personally, but and to do what we can. But the United States government needs to stay the hell out of it, because the problem is that it's what we say. We have these lofty ideals, right? We have these big lofty ideals. We're going to go in and help people. And it's like the bull in the china shop. What have we done in the Middle East in the last 50 years other than drive the Soviets out, that has caused any sort of stabilization? We haven't. We've destabilized the region, right? We've taken out secular regimes and we've replaced them with theocratic regimes, intentionally, often, but we do it unintentionally. And that's the problem. Libertarians always have we are looking for the unintentional consequences of our behaviors, of our foreign military interventions, and the war hawks and the sycophants and the people who think missiles blowing up are beautiful. Those people, of course, don't think about it. They don't care. Often they either profit directly from the military-industrial complex, right? They're either getting paid by, you know, the companies that build the bombs directly. We saw Raytheon stock was up. Or they're just useful idiots for the for those people. And that's really what the problem is here. So let's talk some more about useful idiots. Trump's troll army. Trump's troll army from Politico isn't ready for war in Syria. The alt-right crowd breaks with the president. The fractured elements of what was once called the alt-right were unified once more on Thursday night in condemning Donald Trump's airstrike in Syria as a mistake, or as Milo Yiannopoulos put it, quote, fake and gay. This loose confederation of web-savvy, anti-establishment right-wingers formed an important vanguard of Trump's online support in last year's election, and its unified opposition to the airstrike forewarns a political downside to intervention in Syria. While foreign wars tend to boost president's popularity in the short term, Trump risks losing the segments of his base that flock to his isolationist America First message. In addition to its nationalist, anti-interventionist, and anti-globalist views, the alt-right and its fellow travelers have also displayed a marked affinity for Syria's ally, Russia, whose government has returned the love by tweeting images of the alt-right's mascot, Pepe the Frog, from official accounts. In reacting to the airstrikes, leaders of the movement placed those ideological reflexes over their personal loyalty to Trump. Most noteworthy were the Herculean efforts of blogger Mike Cernovich, who took to the live-streaming application Periscope to rally opposition to the strike in a marathon session that went on for several hours. Just days after Donald Trump Jr. suggested he be given a Pulitzer Prize, Cernovich tweeted, "Sources telling me U.S. attack in Syria planned for tonight. We must stop. No more war, hashtag." At 7:40 p.m. Eastern Time, an hour and a half before NBC News broke the news of the airstrike. During the course of the live stream, Cernovich, at times holding his infant daughter Sira in his arms, blamed a variety of actors for fomenting the conflict. Quote, "They want war. Deep state. All these people want it, man," he said. Of the media, he said, "They're trying to con Trump into believing that the people want war." And, you know, if you guys don't know much about Mike Cernovich, you're lucky. I mean, count yourself lucky. But here he sounds very libertarian in a sense, right? Cernovich also expressed his belief that Syrian dictator Bashar Assad had been framed for the chemical attack, though he had not decided by whom. Quote, "It was probably ISIS did it to themselves," he said on the live stream, while also tweeting, "Did McCain give moderate rebels, ISIS, in Syria poison gas and Hollywood-style film equipment?" See, that's where, you know that the guy's kind of nutty. So that's the problem is that, you know, you have a good message there, but then you wrap it in an aluminum foil hat and you're screwed. Vice Media co-founder Gavin McInnes, founder of pro-Trump Western Chauvinist Fraternal Organization, the Proud Boys, joined Cernovich as a guest via Skype and shared his skepticism. To illustrate a parallel from his own life, McInnes recounted a story in which he said a female friend accused a man of rape, and McInnes violently confronted the man, only to be convinced of the man's incredulous response that he was not guilty of rape. In a text message, McInnes, who left Vice a decade ago, maintained his skepticism about the source of the chemical weapons attack, but signaled support for Trump's response. Yeah, some people are cowards. Earlier in the day, alt-right online philosopher Stefan Molyneux, good God, Stefan Molyneux, congratulations, bro, you're alt-right, also joined Cernovich to condemn the action and question whether Assad was really responsible for the chemical weapons attack. Other callers offered even more disturbing theories. One man expressed his concern that the, quote, deep state had approached Trump and threatened to kill him and his family if he did not get in line, and voiced his suspicion that, quote, the whole thing could be traced back to Barack Obama's national security advisor, Susan Rice. Yeah, could be, responded Cernovich. Others who have been associated with the alt-right were similarly dismayed by the news. Yiannopoulos, who's kept a low profile since losing a CPAC speaking gig and a six-figure book deal over revelations that he once spoke favorably of pederasty, declined to elaborate on a text message describing the airstrike as, quote, fake and gay. White nationalist Richard Spencer, whose embrace of hardcore racism has led Yiannopoulos and others to distance themselves from the alt-right label, displayed no such reticence, calling the strike a, quote, sad, shocking, and deeply frustrating moment. I condemn the strikes, he said. I'm going to wait and see. Perhaps Trump is slapping Assad across the nose and won't go further. Perhaps Russia was informed of the attacks. Worst case scenario, we're replaying the 2000s. A conservative comes to office on a populist message and becomes a globalist and neocon shill. Again, I'll wait and see, but I'm prepared to denounce Trump. Spencer was not alone in vacillating between condemnations of the strike and expressing hope that Trump will not take further action against Assad. The anonymous alt-right Twitter troll Ricky Vaughn tweeted, "There is no endgame in Syria if we remove Assad. No leader that can hold together that country." He also tweeted, "Hoping that this is 88D chess, giving Trump political space and excuse for meeting with and negotiating with Putin." Over on the Donald subreddit, a central hangout for Trump's alt-right fans, debate raged all night. One poster attempted to douse the discontent by writing, "Calm the F down, all you concerned trolls. This isn't World War III. It's Trump putting America first. We need to stop Assad from killing his people. They flee, and guess where they're going?" The political section of the message board site 4chan, another hotbed of online Trump support, was similarly torn asunder by the news, with one poster writing, "Politics hates Trump now. What happened?" Meanwhile, internet troll Charles Johnson was not prepared to accept that the U.S. really had struck at Assad, saying that a source at CENTCOM told him the strike had actually targeted the Islamic State. "I'm very skeptical of any claims made in the media on military matters," he said, "especially since the Iraq War." And, you know, that is the problem when you try and think of the alt-right as some sort of unitary movement. It just really isn't. There isn't some sort of monolithic movement of the alt-right, just like there isn't in the libertarian movement, right? There's all kinds of different libertarians, just like there's all kinds of different conservatives. There are all kinds of different libertarians. There's different libertarian sects, there's different conservative sects, there's different alt-right sects, and there are different liberal and Democrat sects. And so you can't think of the alt-right as necessarily entirely monolithic, or as one person as a spokesman for the alt-right, whereas, you know, another person may not be. And a lot of people have been distancing themselves because the label has become rather toxic. Like libertarians, our label is, you know, a little toxic, I would say, but that's not my fault. I think that I'm helping, but maybe I'm not. A lot of people don't like me and think that I'm toxic, so it's impossible to win in today's political environment. You just got to do the best you can and hope for the best, because it's dark days, really, ladies and gentlemen. But yeah, what I did find interesting about this, and I'll comment on this article now. What I found interesting about this was that people like Paul Joseph Watson and James Alsip and others, they came out immediately almost and were disavowing Trump, but then many of them walked it back. So Paul Joseph Watson said he's done with Trump, but then the next day he's like, "Yeah, I'm okay. No, I'm not leaving the Trump train." Well, he must know where his audience is, right? So remember, like, the people at InfoWars, people like James Alsip, people who are the quote unquote libertarians for Trump. You can't look at those people and say, yes, this is a person of credibility with whom I really should be listening to, because the point of them being successful is that they have to say what their audience wants to hear, or else they will not be successful. You can't, right? You can enjoy a bit of success as an outsider, one who speak your truth, Tommy. But in the end, you have to bow to the advertiser revenues. You have to bow to the traffic on the website. You have to bow to your sponsors. You have to bow to your audience in some respects, unless you're fully independent. And again, I brag obviously on myself, but the thing is that the beauty of what I'm doing here right now and speaking to you, the audience, is that there are no corporate masters. There are no corporate strings. I have walls between me and my advertisers in a certain way that make it so that I can be completely free to creatively express myself. And some people have asked me, because it's a big scandal in the past few weeks about YouTube and demonetization and things like that, because if you're not familiar with the news, YouTubers have received an enormous loss in revenue recently, mostly people in news and politics. The Wall Street Journal published a story about how Coca-Cola ads and AT&T ads and things like that were appearing on videos that had racist content. And so many of these advertisers just pulled something like $750 million, almost $1 billion of advertising money away from YouTube, and a lot of advertisers have pulled out, and YouTubers are getting hit hard. And not racist YouTubers, like normal, rational, healthy people are getting harmed, because what happens is that when you pull the advertisers out of the system, now we're talking about the media and stuff like that, but the media, it's important, you know, when it comes to things like the Syria strike and shaping public opinion. It used to be that the mainstream media had a stranglehold on public opinion. Now we have people like myself and other alternative media groups that can go out and say what they want, make a living doing what they're doing what I'm doing right now. And it's sort of broken up some of the monopoly, the stranglehold that the mainstream media has. People like Brian Williams, who thought the missile strikes were beautiful for whatever reason. But what has happened is that now that they've pulled all of these advertisements, because some of their ads appeared on racist content, there's not enough ads to go around, so everybody's CPM rates have fallen. And they're, not only is that the problem, right? So CPM is a cost per milla, so it means how much money you make per thousand views, for example, on your YouTube videos. But not only have they had a problem filling these ads into a lot of these places, because they've pulled out so many that it's just like inventory. Advertisement is like inventory. You have a certain amount of space to put ads in, and then you put in a commercial and in a certain amount of space, but you only have so many commercials to fill. But not only were they doing that, but they're also demonetizing videos. Those are just taking political content, for example, and just removing the ability to make money on it completely, nearly entirely. And so it's been hard for some people who their main source of revenue is on YouTube, for example, and they're going to have to pull out all the stops that they can to try and see what the problem is going to be, or how they're going to make money, for example. But when I look at my YouTube revenue and stuff like that, my main source of revenue is not YouTube. My main source of revenue comes from things like public speaking gigs and from things like advertisements on the Libertarian Republic, which, by the way, if you read the Libertarian Republic or Liberty Viral and, you want to buy some of your merchandise from us, I'd appreciate it. You know, click on some ads at the Libertarian Republic, or don't ad block us. That's a way to help support independent journalism like this. But I have not been harmed on YouTube. Again, I don't make a whole lot of money on YouTube. I'll upload these things to YouTube. So if you're listening to us on YouTube, that thank you very much. Otherwise, subscribe to my YouTube, because it actually hasn't affected me. But people like Dave Rubin, who my interview with him is going to come out here in probably about a week, said that it has harmed him. His CPMs have fallen, and mine have not. My CPMs have actually done fairly well, and that's interesting, because I'm curious to see who's being affected and why, but we don't really know the answer to that yet. But back on to the serious strikes and how that affects the narrative. A lot of these YouTubers, a lot of these alternative media personalities and things like that, they have to bow to the pressure of advertisers, right? They have to bow to the pressure of their audiences. And the beautiful thing is that my audience, they almost never agree with me all of the time. And I would say I've probably done one of the better jobs building an audience, not necessarily of like-minded people, but of diverse people with open minds. People with diverse viewpoints with open minds is the best audience, because even though it's a smaller group than almost everybody else's audience, right? So maybe we get like a million and a half, views and downloads. I get a million podcast downloads a month. I get a million and a half clicks on the Libertarian Republic and Liberty Viral a month. And that's fairly small compared to some of my friends. Like, I've got a friend who's got a pro-Trump blog, and that thing gets like 20 million a month, right? So he has been really negatively harmed by a lot of these advertiser changes, a lot of the, accusations of fake news, right? But what I've done is done a tiered approach, where I've built up brick by brick by brick, built a credible news organization that has a bias, but is as credible as we can possibly be. And we're not always going to get it right. So when I worked at Fox, when I worked at mainstream news organizations, sometimes they would get it wrong too. And I would see how that would happen. And then later I would be like, oh damn, how do we let that slip through? That's the thing, is that a lot of times people put credibility in news organizations and they believe everything that they say, and it's just not true. You've always got to verify and vet things. What you see on TV, you've got to be even more careful. Just because you read it in a book doesn't make it true. And obviously, but unless you're listening to it on the Freedom Report podcast, if you're hearing this right now, this is definitely not fake news. But it's because of my commitment to integrity and my attempt to try and have a credible news organization that I haven't had the wild raging success because I haven't been able to do like what other people do and just make exaggerated claims, hyperbolic claims, and say things like, oh, this was a false flag, blah, 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 right? And do all those things because it's just not true. If I don't have evidence for something, I can't make a claim for it because I pride myself on my integrity. And, you know, while I would love to be rich and it's possible to get rich doing what I'm doing, I haven't gotten there yet. But I think that it's better to play the long game and build up the credibility so that by the time, you know, the Libertarian Republic and Liberty Viral are making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, at that point, I can be like, oh, hey, well, I did it legit, you know, I did it my way. But you have to understand that when it comes to many of these people, you know, they're at war with their own principles. That's what's happening with the alt-right right now. They're at war with their principles, what they really believe, and with the audiences that they have built, supporting people like Donald Trump, supporting people like, you know, that are pro-war, right? So if now the narrative is that we now have to support everything Donald Trump says, well, these people never had principles in the first place. Their principles were always just a ruse to get you to click on their websites, listen to their podcasts, right? Like, listen, I can identify. There is a strong pressure here for me to tell you what you want to hear, to say things like, Donald Trump is great, he's amazing, he doesn't need congressional authorization, these airstrikes were beautiful, we have to stop the Holocaust, you know, Miley Yiannopoulos is daddy, Tommy Lahren, and not only is she incredibly beautiful, but she's also extremely intelligent. You know, I say things like, oh, Glenn Beck, you suck, you know, I hate you now, blah, blah, blah. There's so much pressure to sell out. There's just so much pressure to sell out. Trust me, it would make you feel good if I did. Many of you may be like, oh, yeah, he's telling me what I want to hear. He speaks my basest feelings. I'm going to click on it, reward him with all this stuff. But you know what? Being able to sleep at night is worth more to me. You know, I love money. I would love to be rich, right? But it's just not everything to me. Money's not everything. That's why I argue I'm not really quite an objectivist, right? I do some things out of the good of my own heart because I just think it's important to do that kind of stuff. And not because it necessarily makes you feel good, right? Because then the Randians would turn around and say, but you do it to make yourself feel good. Well, you know, sometimes it hurts. But sometimes I think it's the right thing to do. Sometimes you ought to do things, not necessarily because it benefits you, but because it's good for everybody. And that's called a sacrifice. Right? And some people might actually call that patriotism. But I digress. Well, this has been a really long show. I wanted to talk to you about the Cato Institute's response and all these other guys' response, but I'm afraid I've bored you to death. By the time you've gotten to the end of this live stream on Facebook, I know most of you guys are gone anyway. But if you're on Podbean or if you're on iTunes, you're probably one of those more hardcore fans that listens to the end of the show. So if you are, then I'm not going to punish you, but I will give you an ad here and tell you, do me a favor and just subscribe to all my social networks if you haven't yet. It's free. It's easy to do. You can find me on YouTube, youtube.com/AugiP, youtube.com/AUGGYP. Subscribe to me on YouTube. You can find me on Twitter at AP for Liberty. That's AP, the number 4, Liberty, AP for Liberty. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/producerPeterson. Peterson spelled P-E-T-E-R-S-E-N, Peterson, producer Peterson. So FB.com/producerPeterson. Subscribe there as well. I'm heading to the University of Iowa tomorrow, Iowa City. I will be leaving tomorrow to go speak tomorrow night to the Turning Point organization. I love Turning Point. These kids are awesome. Turning Point, I saw them when I was at CPAC, and it's all these very libertarian and conservative kids holding up make taxation theft again signs, and they seem to be really down with the message. I mean, they were treating me like a rock star when I was there, so I'm super excited to go meet them tomorrow night because they seem to be really down. You down with Augie P? Yeah, you know me. These kids are really good kids, and I'm excited to speak to them. So I'll be there at the University of Iowa tomorrow night. Then next weekend, there's weekend coming up, I'll be speaking at the Liberty Tree Gun Store. There's going to be be a gun show and an amazing sale. They've got like all kinds of incredible deals on guns that they're selling. And a lot of people are actually coming from all over the country to come buy some of these gun deals. I mean, don't forget that the money that you spend getting here, of course, is part of the cost. On Saturday, I will be at April 15th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. I will be at the Liberty Tree Gun Store. It's an anniversary sale. They've got a Smith & Wesson M&P Shield 9mm for $224. And they've got a Taurus Model 709 Slim 9mm for $189. And also, this is kind of the big deal that everybody really liked, but you can get a Ruger 5.56, right, an AR, for $599, right? You can get the Ruger AR-5. They're not paying me to say this, by the way. Just I just think these are really cool deals. But you can get a Ruger 5.56 for $599, right? And then you get a free Ruger 10/22 with it. So not only do you get the AR-556 for $600, but you also get a free 10/22 Ruger. So that's like $200 or $300 worth of savings right there. It's a pretty good deal on guns. And also, if you're trying to buy some 9mm rounds, they've got a pack of 50 for $849. That's pretty amazing, guys. So if you want to come out and see me, I'll be in Carthage, Missouri at the Liberty Tree Gun Store, and they're having a second anniversary sale. So you can check that out. I've actually posted that on my Facebook page, and I would hope to see you guys there if you can make it. Lots of exciting news coming up, all sorts of cool things happening in Augie's world. So thanks so much for listening to the podcast, and I hope you all have a fantastic day.